We're joined on the telephone line by one of our favorite folks to talk with from The Athletic. Steve Buckley joins us. Buck, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon to you, too. What a good time it is to be a Boston sports fan, eh?
Oh, I'll tell you what, it's been a fun ride with this Celtics team, and I was yelling at my TV screen at them back in the early part of the season, and you know, now I'm blowing kisses at the screen. These guys have been so much fun.
It is funny because this morning on one of the Boston stations, they were doing a thing. My dogs are barking, I apologize. They were doing a thing on the most surprising championship teams, if they were to win it. And, of course, you got to put the 2001 Patriots as the most surprising championship team, followed by the 13 Red Sox because they were coming off that awful 2012 season. But in terms of where they were and where they are right now, I would put the Celtics like number three on that list just because back in December, you know, I didn't even write about them early on just because I was so busy with, you know, the Patriots were going to the playoffs and all that. But if I had, I would have said, the team's not going anywhere.
Well, and there was all of the turnover as well with the change in head coach, a change in the director of basketball operations, and nobody knew. But I would say they struck gold in both cases. Brad Stevens has put together a terrific roster. And man, Ime Udoka is just, he's something special from what we've seen so far.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I've been, you know, I mean, I'm sitting in a peanut gallery in these press conferences after games and stuff, trying to get reads on people. And the sense I get from him is, you know, my old Irish grandmother used to use the expression house angel, street devil. and I see a little bit of that in him. I get the sense that when he's with us, he's measured and calm and diplomatic and so forth. I think behind closed doors, I think he speaks with a measure of authority that's hard to stand up to. And I think the players, I don't want to say fear him because that would be overblowing it, but I think they certainly respect him, and he has the attention of the room, let's put it that way.
You had a terrific piece in The Athletic on, the good luck charm of the Celtics, Cedric Maxwell.
Well, I've known Max for many, many years. We did a lot of radio and TV together over the years, and he uttered the famous "I've got the ball" remark into an accidentally open mic when he was on the floor after they won in 08. And poor Sean Grandy was doing his eloquent, you know, after 18 years of trials and tribulation, and all of a sudden the game ball lands in Max's hands and he yells out, "I've got the ball." Well, it turns out that that in 2012, 2010, and most recently in Game 6 in Boston of this series, he was lined up to do a trophy presentation, and the three previous times the Celtics lost. And so finally, this time, they win in Game 7, and he gets the chance to do the trophy presentation. So let's just say he was well-rehearsed for the moment.
But he was great. He was in that moment. But he was, I think, what longtime Celtics fans wanted to see, that bridge from Larry Bird to Jason Tatum.
That is exactly what, I mean, I can't improve on that because, you know, we all love those traditions. We all love when aging stars come out and throw out a first pitch and, you know, the Yankees, old-timers day, Joe DiMaggio would be introduced last and so forth. And a lot of the older Celtics are, you know, John Havlicek is gone now and Tommy Heinsohn, sadly. And, you know, Bob Cousy doesn't make public appearances anymore. He's well into his 90s. And you know, and Larry Bird is not, you know, he's in good health, but he's more or less not a public person anymore. So when you bring out Max, you're bringing up the 1980 Celtics, which is big for all of us to live through that era. And it's great to see Max sort of connect the dots between his era and the team that we're watching right now.
We're talking with Steve Buckley here on Downtown. So the Warriors are favorite in this one, but when you get to this phase in the whole long postseason, I'm not sure those things mean anything. You throw out some of the numbers. What's the formula for the Celtics to be successful against Golden State?
Well, I'm just going to spew some cliches here, but not turning the ball over would be paramount on my list. is as great a player as Tatum is, and he's certainly exciting to watch. And I also, as an aside, I respect, going back to what we just talked about, I have enormous respect for Tatum's respect for the game's history. He embraces old players and players he watched when he was a kid. And, you know, obviously Kobe Bryant was big with him as a child growing up, and LeBron. And it's hard to believe those were the players that he admired as a kid.
Mm.
Because to me, it was like 3 days ago that those guys were playing. But Tatum also has this horrible habit of turning the ball over. And I think sometimes he gets caught up in the moment. And if he plays like a two-way great Celtic throughout this series, I think they're going to win the championship. Not that I'm putting it all on him, but they really need to. The turnovers to me against Miami were really scary, and they need to get rid of that.
But it seems to me that if we believe in the old adage that defense wins championships, this is still, I think, the best defense in the league, although they'll have their work cut out for them.
It is, and they will. I mean, there's no way to improve on what you just said. What I go back to is I don't so much look at the record that the Celtics amassed since opening night, nor do I look at Golden State's record. I look at what the Celtics have done since January, and it's frankly, as you pointed out at the beginning of this little discussion here, it's a completely different team. I mean, it's the same team. In that they, you know, it's not like they overhauled it. You know, Derek White, you know, they added to the roster obviously during the season, but they just started playing in a more cohesive manner, playing team ball and cutting down the mistakes and so forth. And not only is it a very, very good team to watch, it's a very good tutorial team to watch. And what I mean by that is, I was talking to a high school coach, it's just that this is a team whose game highlights you want to show to younger players, as if to say, this is how you play the game. And I respect that viewpoint.
Let's talk a little baseball, as somebody who knows the history of the game well. An interesting bit of history last night: Garrett Whitlock, 6 innings, no strikeouts, no walks.
How about that? I was actually watching that game, and I didn't know that till like the 5th inning. And it's just that there was other stuff going on in the game. And obviously we've seen guys have a few strikeouts, no walks. We've seen guys have no walks and this number of strikeouts, whatever. It's just that he went out there and just put the ball in play. I'm going to give you something that's so old school that I'll surprise even myself, but I remember covering a game in 1987, and I'm going to look it up when I get off with you. Maybe someone will do this later on, but Lee Gutterman, when I was covering the Seattle Mariners back in 87.
Wow, there's a name.
pitched a Saturday afternoon game against the Cleveland Indians when I was traveling with the Mariners, and I remember Pat Corral, as the manager of the Indians, after the game, said that's one of the best pitch games we've ever seen. Now, I'm going to look it up, and maybe he had 6 strikeouts and 3 walks. I just remember there were like 22 ground ball outs. He was throwing. He was a big, tall, lanky lefty, as you remember. And in the entire game, it was ground ball, ground ball, ground ball, ground ball, ground ball. And, you know, low on the strikeouts, low on the walks. I don't think it was 0 walks, 0 strikeouts, but as I was watching last night, it kind of reminded me of that kind of a game where, which by the way, is as much as we love strikeouts, and they're exciting, and Bob Gibson and Clemens and Koufax and stuff, as much as we love strikeouts, there's something to be said for putting the ball in play and having defenders make defensive plays.
Well, in this day and age, especially when it's hard to get a starter past the 5th inning, if you're out there getting guys on 1 or 2 pitches per appearance, and you can hang around a little bit longer.
Yeah, and you know, and I hate sounding like the get off my lawn guy, but one of the things that's kind of missing in baseball right now is the anticipated start.
Mm.
And we had that for a good number of years when you knew when Pedro was going to pitch. I'm going Thursday night, Pedro's pitching. I'm going Friday night, Roger Clemens is pitching. And you know, and we've had little spurts here and there. But those were the two, maybe Lomborg when we were all children. But I just remember when I was at the Boston Herald for all those years, I would look at the schedule, and if Pedro was pitching, if Clemens was pitching, I was a beat guy in those days, but if Pedro was pitching, it was going to be at Fenway, just because you didn't want to miss out on the potential of an incredible game. And we don't really have that now. We have great pitchers, but we don't have those anticipated matchups or those anticipated starts. And it's something that baseball needs to look at, and I'm sure that it's on Theo Epstein's radar. I don't think they can legislate the practice of having a guy go out and pitch one inning as a start. I don't think they can legislate that out of the game. But, boy, we do need to bring back the excitement of the anticipated start.
With the extra wild card and with the fact that we know this team will hit eventually, we've seen signs of it in the last couple of weeks. To me, the big issue is the bullpen, and now Matt Barnes is on injured reserve. What can they do? Is there any help anywhere in the system?
I do not know that. I'd be faking it. I said, I got this kid in Portland or this kid in Worcester. I haven't really, because I've been Bruins and Celtics for the last month and a half, I haven't done my usually at around this time in the old days is when I would make the drive to Pawtucket or read up on Portland and stuff. So I don't know. Chances are the help they get will probably be some kind of trade. But you got to keep in mind that one of the, I don't want to say disadvantages, but one of the realities of an extra wild card is that there are more teams with a chance to make the postseason, and which is good. I think I think baseball, you don't want to overdo it, but you know, one of the problems with baseball for many years is by July, back when they just had AL versus NL, you know, most of the league was out of the pennant race by then. So it's good that there were more teams with a chance to dream, but that means fewer teams unloading players at the trade deadline. And so they would have to be, shall we say, extra clever to find that guy that's going to help them out.
All right, I've got a question for you. There's no right answer, but if there's a guy who can point us in that direction, it's you. Who had the best major league career of former Maine Black Bears, Billy Swift or Mike Bordick?
Oh, wow. I mean, nostalgia guides me toward Billy Swift because I covered Billy for a couple of years. I mean, I covered Billy in Legion. I went to Billy's wedding. so that's where I want to go, but Bordick, for an undrafted player, which he was, Oakland signed him when he went undrafted. I think he had a longer career. I know that Swifty had that, 20 win season 1 year. I don't think Bordick ever had a single season the way Swift did when he went to the National League.
No, and so, he was runner-up in the Cy Young, and then I think another year led the league in earned run average.
Yeah, so I guess you kind of helped me out. Plus, if he hadn't been injured early in his career with the Mariners, and it's really weird because I covered Billy when he played for Eddie Griffin Club in South Portland Legion. I covered him with the Black Bears. I covered him in spring training with the Mariners in '87 because I moved from Portland to Seattle in '87 and covered the Mariners, and I never saw him pitch in the big leagues for the Mariners because if you look in the books, he was getting lit up in spring training. It turned out he needed surgery, and they went to get a look at why he wasn't pitching well in spring training in '87. So he missed that entire season after having surgery. So I never covered him in the big league. I did, I guess, in that I saw him pitch in spring training and so forth, and he was with the team during the season. He made a few trips with us, but he never got into a game. So my history with him goes way, way back from Legion ball to the big league. So I guess I would proudly choose Billy Swift as the greatest Mainer to play in the big leagues.
One of my favorite Billy Swift stories is his first year in the majors. He reached out and talked to a couple of his friends who were still at Maine and was talking about how great it was that they gave him all this meal money every day, and he was eating at McDonald's. Hey, as one of 15 kids, he knew how to save money, and he was pocketing whatever it was, 75, 80 bucks a day in meal money by eating on the cheap.
Well, I'll tell you real quick, I know you got to go, but if you watch Around the Horn on ESPN, Bill Plaschke from the Los Angeles Times, who's a big star now on TV, But you go way back to the early 1980s. Bill Plaschke was the beat writer covering the Mariners for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. And when the Mariners came into Boston for 83, 84, whenever it was, 85, I guess, maybe, whenever Billy pitched his first game at Fenway Park, I was working in Portland, and, of course, we covered it like it was, Paris Peace Talks. Had all kinds of people down there, and, you know, I'm sure Larry was down there from the BDN, Larry Mahoney, and I just remember covering that and the Seattle writers coming up to me, and they wanted, you know, Billy Swift biographical tidbits, and I was 15 kids and Eddie Griffin Club and how he was the best hitter on the Blackbears. He could have been a big league left fielder, you know, and so forth. Well, Bill Plaschke was covering the Mariners, and Bill's a very good friend of mine to this day because I was the go-to guy for Billy Swift information. And in my office, John Ewing used to work for the Portland Press Herald as a photographer, took a great picture of Billy Swift pitching at Fenway in the first inning of his first start at Fenway. And I actually had one of those framed and gave it to Billy at his wedding as a wedding gift. And I had one made for myself. It's up my office now. And it seems kind of quaint looking back on it because, you know, I've covered like a gazillion Super Bowls and World Series and stuff. But back then, that was one of the biggest games I ever covered, and I still get the chills just thinking about it.
That was a great time. Always good talk with you. Steve Buckley of The Athletic. Check out his piece on the Celtics and Cedric Maxwell and everything he does. Always great. Buck, thanks for making time for us this afternoon. Enjoy those games.
Take care of yourself.
Steve Buckley on Downtown.